your trailer and your locked position. Make sure that you have your seat belts fastened. Good morning, I'm Dr. Stephen Holt, and welcome to October 4th. If you can believe that, the year is running through, and we are chasing it, or enjoying it one way or the other. We're here. This is the Bond Oversight Committee. In case you were looking for a different meeting, you've stumbled into the Bond Oversight Committee meeting, and we've got a lot to do. If you haven't grabbed the materials, they are right at the sign-in table. I want to make sure that we've got your information as well so that you can get updates and stay on the email list to know what's happening. We're going to go through, as you see, what's in front of us, and we'll do a brief roll call and then get going. So, beginning with you, sir, directly in front of me.
Todd Struble, Oversight Committee. Good morning, Alan Lazo, the Fair Housing Council of Oregon, and member of the Bond Oversight Committee.
Good morning, Jess Larson, Bond Oversight Committee.
Carl Dinkelspiel, Portland Housing Bureau.
Tanya Wolfersberger, Portland Housing Bureau.
Good morning, Shannon Callahan, Portland Housing Bureau.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here. Let us begin. Director Callahan.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us today. We have a very full agenda this morning. Since the last time we met, we have a number of new acquisitions and a lot of progress to report on where we are with the bonds. I know that the whole team here with you today, including the Portland Housing Bureau and our partners in Implementation Home Forward, are really excited to share information with you. I also wanted to remind you that we are having a little ice cream social tomorrow afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. We'd invite all of our bond oversight. Oh gosh, I thought tomorrow was Saturday. I'm a day ahead of myself. On Saturday, thank you, Carl, from 2 to 3 p.m. And we've been flyering the folks at the Ellington, hoping to have a little event for the kiddos. I don't see Michelle to pass in the audience yet. Michelle, our community engagement coordinator, has been working hard to make this an event that'll be hopefully fun for the families and kiddos. So we'll have face painting. Alan, I know you're interested in that.
I'm a big face painter.
From our Girl Scout troop, the local fire station, I believe it's station 28, we'll be bringing a fire truck out because nothing draws kids, in my opinion, like a fire truck to play on. We'll also have a little bit of a raffle for the kids and ice cream. So please join us. We'll be doing some pictures, and it's just our chance to kind of say thank you and welcome the families officially who are living there and have moved in, of which you'll hear a little bit more about in our presentation this morning. So the other thing I wanted to bring to your attention is the impending potential of a constitutional amendment, which, as you know, will be before Oregon voters on November 6th, so just a month and 2 days away. The constitutional amendment will have the ability to change the model that we're currently using. As you all know, we have the current constitutional restrictions make it very difficult for us to leverage any dollars into projects from other sources other than the city funds or county funds you've seen us use. So we have used some, a little bit of URA funds here or there. As you know, we have received a contribution from the county for $4 million to work on the capital capital improvements and or complete replacement of the west wind. But we are not able to use tax credits, which is the primary vehicle for subsidizing affordable housing in the private and nonprofit development community, nor are we able to take a traditional bank loan. We have been working with a series of banks and through our partners at NOAA, but we are not able to offer the assets, the bond assets, up as security for loans. And so this is a very difficult product to work out. If the amendment passes, we have a lot of more, we have a lot more opportunity. But with that also comes a lot of trade-offs. And I know we'll talk with you about that. LIHTC, low-income tax credits, have their own rules. Some of what we'll be talking about today are rules that we've been able to propose or create specialties, you know, because we're not using some of those different types of funds. So it will be a discussion I think we have at the trade-off level. The other thing I wanted you to know is the city had a position as we moved through this stakeholder advisory group framework regarding the assets and liabilities. So there has been a deep concern from our financial team and our Office of Management and Finance regarding having a liability on our books, i.e. the bond, but having the asset owned by another entity. We've had early conversations with our chief financial officer, she is very amenable to talking about different ways of doing business than what we had discussed last year. So we are going to be working with her office very closely. We've already had initial conversations, but we're sitting down in full form with her team next week and with our lawyers to try to craft ways to be able to potentially have ownership in another entity with a potential for the city having at least a piece of ownership relating to the dollars of the bond potentially. But we're going to relook at that issue in advance of the constitutional amendment's potential passage. So that's just, I wanted to give you a little bit of what we're doing behind the scenes. I know that that's probably on your mind as we're going into November. And, you know, if the amendment does pass, we'll be having a conversation with you likely shortly thereafter. We may have to do, we may do a special meeting with you, or December, I believe, is our next time, which may be adequate for us to know more details, but we'll keep you up to speed on that. So knowing that I was tardy for this event, I am going to shorten my time. And unless you have any questions, I think we'll move on to the meat of the agenda this morning.
I have a question about the ownership piece under 102. And I don't know if this is a good time to talk. In a month it'll be too late to talk about it. Mm-hmm. So what have you explored, or what do you know about potential ownership structures then, if the amendment does pass? What have you looked at? So I guess I hadn't thought much about that. I guess most of those properties are owned by nonprofit affordable housing partners. And what would the city's ownership look like then in your discussions and that structure?
So, Ellen, I don't know that we have how it looks, but I think what we want to do is explore that possibility. I mean, there are possibilities of us under the with the constitutional amendment of potentially even creating a limited liability mm-hmm. company where the city has a right. portion of that, yeah. a nonprofit could have a portion of that, LIHTC investors would have a large portion of that. There could be a situation where we look at presently we use a regulatory agreement, so we don't have a portion with our traditional model, leverage model, not the bond, where we have a regulatory agreement on the building, which essentially works as somewhat of a loan without repayment, et cetera, as long as the terms of appropriating affordability are met. So I think that we are entering into new territory as to what that may look like. We know that the state has had to address this a little bit with their LIFT funds, and so their bonds are under a different constitutional right. provision. So we have some ideas about what that may look like, but we don't, let me just say we have not fleshed that out yet. You know, there's also likely, we're also looking at all of our portfolio of assets that we've purchased to see what, if any, of those would be appropriate for a different type of leverage model. Some may be, some may not be. The only one that is off the table is the Ellington, because it was purchased and bonded with already using our bonding authority, so we've already issued bonds. Everything else we've done has been done with an interim finance method. Though I will say there's something like the West Wind, where we're programming a building that is, at present our thought is it'll be an all deeply affordable building. Predominantly permanent supportive housing. That's unlikely,
to be a model or building type that we would be able to use any kind of real leverage on, because there's just not enough rents being created to pay back any type of other investor, nor LIHTC rules would probably be a barrier in some cases to what we may be wanting to do in terms of access. So that I think is a real discussion we'll have to have with you as to what those trade-offs are, because there are trade-offs in terms of who gets access, especially when it comes to LIHTC rules. And we've worked really hard to create a screening criteria and some of the policies you'll see today regarding over-income tenants or over-income tenants at acquisition, which would not flow completely with LIHTC. So we will be looking to leverage as much as we can, but I think we also need to be mindful of what those trade-offs are.
The upside with Measure 102 is it gives us the opportunity. It doesn't require us to enter into those agreements. So all it's doing is giving us that opportunity, and then we still have the opportunity to measure whether or not that's the best route for what we're trying to accomplish.
Exactly. Yeah. I think our recommendation is going to be, though, that we do try to leverage a number of the different properties. I think the question is what are we trying to accomplish with those properties? Are we stabilizing families where they are, for instance? Are we looking at properties that we want to really prioritize people with a lot of challenges getting into housing, for instance, with permanent supportive housing? So I think it's just going in eyes wide open, but we will be seeking to create more units. But we have to, it's something we'll have to grapple with as a whole. But please know that we, and I'm looking at our lovely team with Home Forward and the Housing Bureau, we're looking at the portfolio of assets now to see what's possible and bring you some recommendations if the, I'm not supposed to say when, I'm supposed to say if the constitutional amendment passes. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Director. I need to make mention, we did not review and approve our minutes, and I just made a decision to move past that in light of our timing. We can, at the end, if you're okay with that, we'll go back and do that. So. Wonderful. Primers report, dashboard.
Hey, good morning. I'm going to try to go through this quickly, but not too quickly. My rapid fire. Just to give you a sense of where we're at, progress-wise, we're in a wonderful position with 5 bond-identified properties, as you can see up on the slide. Some of these are existing buildings. The existing buildings, clearly we know what the unit count is. The land that we purchased are planned numbers, estimated numbers, so it's a combination when we get to our total unit count. Those approximation numbers are will be a little bit fluid until we know kind of what our plans are, and we'll go through that a little bit later. But just as you can see location-wise where we're at so far, when we look through the lens of location priorities, I think we're also, this is a nice illustration of the disbursement of bond funds throughout the city so far. Also highlight some of the areas we would still like to be in. We'll get there soon. And then just our going back to revisit the progress measures. Again, some of these numbers are fluid under the unit counts of supportive housing, 30% family size. So it represents committed and planned numbers. But I think we're using conservative numbers in the planned numbers, so they will change a little bit as programming and pre-development plans come together. Projects.
Are there no pending? Is everything secured?
Everything is relatively complete. We are in the final stages of the West Wind acquisition, but everything else is complete.
Just a little bit more on that.
Yeah.
So the stuff that was pending is we discontinued. Pursuing those.
Okay. Yeah. So we are in the process of identifying new opportunities to fill in the pending shades of the bars.
Yeah. Just to clarify, either we or the sellers discontinued. Mm-hmm. So some were choices made by the Housing Bureau, and some were actually choices made by the seller, mm-hmm. but for whatever reason, they did not mature. There are two other opportunities that we have yet to bring to the bond RFI committee that we presently have. There is one we're talking about tomorrow afternoon with the RFI committee, and then we'll be following up shortly with an additional property. But until we actually have a RFI committee who says, yes, please go forward, we would not count those as a pending project.
Right. Thank you. Can I ask one additional follow-up to that? I was actually thinking about the supportive housing units bar. That's great to see us tracking a slightly ahead of schedule, if you will. Does that indicate not only that they've been designated, but there's funding available for those 198 supportive housing units? Great.
I would say that's kind of fluid as well, but again, that's what we are hoping to accomplish. And as those buildings, like 30th and Powell, get constructed, and we'll
sure.
be working to secure that.
So, and specifically, Jess, right now, the West Wind, all of what we've programmed so far, oh, I apologize. All of what we've, the West Wind, I think, is a big question mark for us. We know that we don't have the funding secured for that, for the permanent supportive housing service portion. But if we know that we're moving toward that direction, and we believe we're moving toward that direction, and we need to plan for those resources accordingly. So the joint office is fully aware of where we're going with that direction, and we are constantly having discussions about prioritization of current funds and potential new funds. I would hope that if there were any new source of funds that were identified for permanent supportive housing, the West Wind would rise to the top of that list, just in case anybody knows.
So the $4 million that the county put in for the West Wind? $4 million the county put in for the West Wind is capital then, not for services?
Yes, they had approximately $4.6 million left from the sale of Wapato.
Oh.
And they have agreed to, it's one-time, not ongoing funding. So they've agreed to contribute $4 million of that. They had about $600,000 for other programming related to supportive housing and people experiencing mental illness. But it's a huge contribution and a wonderful statement, I think, by both jurisdictions of their deep commitment to the work regarding supportive housing.
Do you want to do questions about the progress measures overall right now, or are we going to go through each?
Do you want, if you have questions, go for it.
So I think these are great because they do give us that kind of snapshot overall. And so, when we look at this, and the bars are good, we're not quite to 50% on units, but we're over 50% on both the funds and the project-based vouchers. So there's probably, I'm assuming there's also potentially a relationship between the project-based vouchers and the 0 to 30% AMI units. And so we're above on vouchers but below on units. And same thing, so that relationship exists. And then also there's a relationship between the funds invested and the total units, and they're both inverse right now. So is there a concern in any of those areas? And the project-based vouchers is one, and AMI are one question, but the other one I think is probably for Carl, since he had the original model. Are you concerned where we are now? Because that's what we talk about, right? At some point, if those two things diverge, we're going to have to play catch-up.
Right.
And so I don't know if we're not there yet, right, from what you know, or what we see on the table.
Yeah, and I think the sort of the key here is that, if we can go back to the slide with all the projects on it. So when you look at those, right, there's only two that are actually, that are existing and occupied projects, right? And so of those, the other three, right, so Prescott is just simply a piece of land, as well as Powell. So there's a lot of flexibility around how to, I think, what Tanya said earlier about, these are projections, right? This is sort of our best guess at how this would go. And, we are sort of constantly measuring, how we're doing relative to those goals, which is why, we show them. but also recognizing that we have this, you know, we're trying to get to all of the goals, you know, by the time the program's over, right?
Right.
And so there's got to be some sort of flexibility around how those resources are. So I'm not that worried about it, you know, and I think as we start to firm these things up, it becomes much more of a challenge. And, you know, Justin and I have actually talked about this relative to the Metro's bond, right? Right. We have that same, like, well, sure. as you start getting towards the end and you're trying to get to those goals, you know, if you haven't accomplished them, what do you do? Yeah. So I would look at those as, because there's sort of a lot of things that are still up in the air that they're somewhat flexible.
Thanks.
Carl, may I ask you a question?
Why, certainly.
So, Carl, based on these numbers, for instance, and where we are, absent a constitutional amendment, and we were looking at new construction versus acquisition, the numbers that you have before us would indicate probably more likely that we would be doing
acquisitions. So, yeah, we're talking about that earlier. That I think that's sort of a key point for us, and you know, just something to track is, you know, the original model was somewhat heavy on acquisition, and I think we sort of knew internally that we would have to do that. But you know, as real numbers show up, as things get locked in, so to speak, right? We have less room to maneuver, and therefore, you know, we'd have to look at sort of less expensive options. And typically, acquisition is going to be somewhat less expensive than new construction.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Good. Thanks. Yep.
Okay. We are going to move right along to the Ellington. A few months ago, you all had asked us to provide some more information around the kind of who's living at the Ellington and some demographic background. So we have that information. I think if you have a chance to look at it beforehand, we'll just go through some overview of who's currently residing at the Ellington. And I think thanks to the hard work of Home Forward's asset management team and property managers, we have a lot of great information about who is currently residing there. One of the nice things that we wanted to point out is that we are exceeding our 30% AMI income targets at the property, which is wonderful to know. I think we had a target of 80 units. We currently have 93 households that are making less than 30% AMI, and 117 households making between 31 and 60% area median income. So that's kind of a great snapshot of that. Of that group of 93 households, 47, we believe are over income. 10 households have verified as have over income, and that means that we're kind of uncertain of the balance. That 35 units we're not really sure of. They haven't verified their income through the management office. I think we had some discussions previously about if we were doing correct outreach to those tenants to make sure that they were receiving the information and understanding the information. Property management sent them a final written notice. They have on that notice on the front page is safe harbor languages that says, you know, this is an important document, please have it translated. So it's some assurances that we have made some efforts to make sure that folks who don't speak English as their first language can access that information appropriately. So that is the effort that's been made at this point to get folks to come in. So we're still unsure, you know, there are various reasons why folks don't want to come in and verify their income. They'll keep working at it, I'm sure. We also wanted to just kind of note that we found that 35 households are also overhoused, and we'll discuss that a little bit later when we get to kind of like policy discussions.
I did that.
What happened?
I was trying to be helpful.
There you go. Oh,
Zaya, you were beside it.
Yeah, we're going to get on there.
You ready for
that? I'm ready for that. We're going to go back a little bit.
All right.
Just more detail of kind of like the income, the breakdown of incomes at the property. This is kind of a nice highlight of who's who. As I was saying, 93 households are at 0 to 30% AMI, 117 households at the next kind of grouping. 10 have confirmed as over income, which means they're 61% AMI or higher, and 35 are unknown. In addition, we've got seven, at the time of this report, there were 7 vacant units and 1 manager's unit. If you're doing the math in your head.
Yeah, thank you. This looks like it's a breakdown of the incomes of households, so people coming forward and doing their income verification. What rents are these households paying? Are they paying the 30% rent if they are a household under 30%? Or are some, I think what we learn is that some are actually households under 30% but actually paying a 60% rent. And then my additional question is this how we found tenants? They were living in apartments when we bought the building and the rent was at about 60% but they only had 30% incomes? Or have people actually been moving in under very low incomes in the 60%? Because we've owned the building now for 2 years, and so maybe you can talk a little bit more about, are we moving people into units that are much higher rent than their income, or is this where they were when we got them? I'm sure it's a matter.
Good questions, Jess. So I asked Molly Rogers from Home Forward to help.
Yeah, let's break that apart. So it's obviously it's a combination, but obviously we didn't know when we first bought, when the city bought Ellington. It did take a whole year and a half to really get all this data compiled. How do we establish what income definition are we going to use? How do there was thoughts of what the initial set asides were meant to be, but we didn't actually know what the profile really was. So, and at the same time, we didn't have incomes rising in place policies set at that moment in time. So it's been a little bit of a learning. It's been a learning curve. For the past almost 2 years of really trying to understand the demographics of the Ellington. So yes, there are some residents who are earning 30% or below, living in 60% units, but that is partly by design because we also want to make sure that we can best utilize our project-based Section 8 vouchers that we initially had set out to use. So we set a goal of 52, and we are on target to want to be able to use 52 PBV. So the next step, and this is at this critical juncture, we wanted to move forward quickly to get those project-based Section 8 vouchers deployed so then those folks would not be rent burdened. But by virtue of how the housing is, we're never going to eliminate all rent burden, just by virtue of the city's income to rent ratio policy. Folks can come in and have access to housing and yet still be rent burdened. So we are on target to having 80% of the, or 80 units restricted at 0 to 30, with 52 of those being project-based Section 8. And then as people move in, so those then, once we do the voucher deployment, those, the PBVs and those restrictions will then essentially be locked in by those, at those specific units. So as people, as turnover happens, we will then have those rent restrictions be set, and those people have to become qualified to move into those units.
Can I ask a clarifying question? Mm-hmm. So currently there are 93 households who would qualify for housing at 30% income or below. They don't necessarily pay rent at that rate, but they would qualify.
Just to clarify, 28 of them are already in a 0 to 30 rent restricted unit.
Okay.
So it's actually only 69 that would potentially qualify for a PBV. We will deploy 52 vouchers,
yep.
But we know not all 69 will either be eligible or will actually go in and go through the full process to get the PBVs. So we actually think 52 is a target that we will, it will be very close to meeting the need of folks who will come in and want it and be eligible for those vouchers.
Will, so that leaves from tracking, that would leave 13 households at 30% MFI who won't be in, won't have housing, won't have a rent that's affordable at 30% MFI. They'll have a 60% rent. Were any of those 13 households moved in with the expectation that they would have the opportunity for 30% MFI rent?
No.
Okay.
No.
And will those households be on a wait list of sorts to have the opportunity to move into, or to not move, but absorb 30% rent if through transition?
Yes, so that is a common practice. If you have some established restricted units, which we'll have, you can create a preference, if you will, for those folks who can get on a like transfer list. Mm-hmm. And then as those units come online, we can do kind of a swap of restrictions as we need to, if the same bedroom sizes all or everything else is the same. So yeah, we can, that is part of the income rising in place policy that we're trying to, you know, talk about at the same time. What's been great is being able to see, look, actually how the policies will play out with real demographic information in mind. And we've had to go through all the various different scenarios, how this will play out based on kind of a really set of nuanced set of household compositions. I don't know, I haven't looked, dive deeply into the exact, we don't know yet of those 69 who will actually get those vouchers and whether they'd be eligible. It does get a little bit complicated if those folks are overhoused, and some of them are. Mm-hmm. If you're overhoused, you are, you're not eligible for, so let's say overhoused is where you have, let's say you're a one person household, but you're residing in a two bedroom, or you're just, your household size is smaller than what the occupancy standard is for a voucher. And the voucher will only pay for your household size, not your bedroom size. So if you still choose to have a larger bedroom, the difference in the payment standard between those different the bedroom sizes will get passed on to that household. We find in many instances overhoused folks it's not beneficial for them to actually have a voucher because their purchasing power is that much lower. So there's some of those things will sort of shake out as we go through the process of really finding out who will really come in and be eligible for those project-based sectioning vouchers.
Can we give people preference to other buildings? So if someone's overhoused at the Ellington, 30% MFI, but living in a two-bedroom apartment and not likely to get a one-bedroom apartment at Ellington for that, could we get them on a list for East Burnside, for example?
We could think through that. The one thing is we have to think through those have already existing preferences that we're wanting to establish of getting people right out of homelessness into that housing. So we have to weigh sort of the public benefit of folks who are actually in housing but just happen to be rent burdened, which is unfortunately not that atypical in a lot of our affordable housing properties. We have a lot of rent burdened folks. We generally create preferences to try to sort of move the needle on the homelessness, ending homelessness realm than we are for people who are currently housed. But we do create sometimes transfer abilities. People can go, certainly can, no one will prevent them from getting on a wait list at another building that has lower restrictions. They could certainly do that.
And I'll just add that this is a great example of another thing that this exercise uncovered is that there's a deep need for resident services at this property, and a resident services coordinator obviously would help tenants in that situation find a unit, a 30% unit that would work for them, whether it's at the Ellington or Burnside or somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. My concern is, my concern is for people who are rent burdened, but I understand that that's a very common occurrence in our housing supply. It's more about if we are causing someone to have to move out of housing because they are overhoused, when we take acquisition of a building, that we find an opportunity for them to access something that's in a range that's reasonable for them.
So we actually have had pretty long and detailed conversations about overhoused and some of the situations that we're seeing kind of play out with the Ellington. We're glad we've taken some time with this, and we've had a number of conversations. I think when we get to the end kind of about the over-income policies that we're planning to propose. That'll help flesh out maybe some of our thought process there and what we plan to do. I mean, Ellington also has some issues in terms of, it's a mostly family-sized building. So if someone is overhoused and they're single, you know, we want to make sure, for instance, in our policy that you'll see that we don't try to increase rents on them until they've been offered a one-bedroom unit. So that will mean that we're, you know, adjusting for a long time until that becomes available. If they so choose not to take that unit, we will then take the next steps, but that will be their choice. We're not going to do that until there is a choice for them. So that's kind of what we've tried to think through a number of scenarios. I don't know that we've captured everything, but to say that this is the policy that you'll see this afternoon has been really thoughtfully worked over a period of months. That's why this data was really helpful to us to try to kind of play out those scenarios.
Yep, and this, just to reiterate Shannon's point, because there are some one bedrooms, that is how we're handling the folks who are overhoused at the Ellington, is we're giving them a choice, a transfer option to move into the one bedroom, and then having much, at that point, much lower rent, as well as right, giving that opportunity for the two bedrooms to have larger families in there. Hunter.
Okay. All right, so let's keep moving along. Just wanted to also share kind of the demographics that we were able to collect on the Ellington, which, you know, highlight is that the population currently at the Ellington is a higher representation than the census tract in the communities of color in all categories except for one, the Asian category. Community is lower than the current census tract, so that was an interesting highlight and something that we will have to work on to address to make sure that our outreach and engagement efforts and referral efforts are in line to see if we can increase that to be more in line with the community at hand. So we know that that all of the other communities are higher, which is a nice thing to see. We also created to address some of your guys' questions about community partner referrals. So we know that there's several agencies that have referred one or more households to the Ellington and have successfully moved in. Some of those are Transition Projects, Human Solutions, El Programa Catalico, Northwest Pilot Project, SEI, JOIN, IRCO, NARA, NEA. DHS, Domestic Violence Department, and the Portland Family Homeless Services. So a great group of kind of, you know, who you might expect would be making referrals to the property. So we've been able to verify that that is happening and that we're making housing opportunities available for communities of color in particular. Yes, Jess.
Sorry, I'm not keeping you on track here.
That's okay.
I actually received a call from one of the service providers who made a referral to the Ellington with the hopes that their clients referred would be able to qualify for 30% MFI housing or a project-based voucher more specifically, and wanting to know how long until they would have that more affordable rent. Not to get into the specifics of that, but more of a general request that I'm imagining there might be several service provider agencies subsidizing rents for folks waiting for the project-based vouchers to be applied for the tenants they help to house, and that would be a huge savings to the supportive services community. And so kind of an update, a request for an update on the timing of applying those project-based vouchers and hoping that we can expedite that as quickly as possible.
Yes, we are, now that we've got this data and we've been able to really understand the demographics, there's two next steps. One is we really are hearing from site staff and even from some of the agencies, we really do need some resident services there. We're about to get to how many kids are living at the property. And now it's the overall demographics have shifted. As you can see, it's a huge number of new households. So we're really needing to get in there and really help get some information resources for those families. At the same time, we're hoping to also do the project-based Section 8, sort of converging those two together in the next 3 months. So it does take some time to go through a whole process. There's a whole Section 8 process we have to go through in terms of getting it approved through HUD. We've got through that process, and then now it's being able to do a comprehensive marketing of those vouchers. That will take a little bit of time, but our hope is to start, at least people starting to know at the beginning of this next calendar year about going through that various process. It will probably take, I'm guessing, 3 to 4 months to go through the whole process, because you have to offer the vouchers to existing residents first.
Molly, so that's why we waited until we had a higher number of 0 to 30 families in the building, as opposed to layering on the vouchers early. If we had layered on the vouchers early, they would have gone potentially to higher families.
That
and so
helps.
We needed, you know, and this is one of the issues that we're going to have to face with these buildings, is we need to get and have a little bit of time to get to get people a little bit of natural attrition happening and be able to move in a healthy number of families, so that we're sure that the resources, as sure as we can, that the resources that we have with the project-based vouchers from Home Forward are actually going to serve those in most in need. So that unfortunately creates the situation with this time lag, but that's why we're at this point right now. We have enough data, we know that we're at the right place, that if we overlay them, we believe there's enough families that will qualify. There are a few things in families' backgrounds that will not qualify them with a federal Section 8 voucher. So, you know, we also have to make sure we have a little bit of healthy room there for people who may have something that's a disqualifying factor. So that's really kind of, just so you know.
That helps a lot.
That's a good point.
Okay.
I have a question about the referrals from culturally specific agencies. Is there an API specific agency that's making referrals? I know ERCO has the Asian Family Center. I don't know, is there any other organization because they would be serving both homeless people experiencing homelessness and culturally specific? Is that right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, and I don't know that we are aware of a specific agency. For that community, I think that would be something that we would want to look into more and make sure that those connections are made.
Okay. Yeah, well, I was speaking with Carl earlier about how there's sometimes a lack of organizational capacity for API community. So maybe that's related to the lack of representation on the census tract data as well. So.
Jennifer's going to chime in.
Yeah. So on the Ellington.
Oops, sorry.
So for the community partner list that we use for the Ellington, it was mainly ERCO, Asian Family Center, and then in our subsequent list for Burnside in the future, we added Asian Health Services, and I think to your point, when we were looking at the data around the census, so there's the demographics of people residing in the Ellington, the communities of color are higher than in the census, except for when you look at the Asian ethnic group, right, where it's underrepresented. And so that flags for us the need to do more focused outreach and inclusion of that in our outreach list. So, yeah.
Any more questions? Nope. All right. I might start speaking a little more rapidly. Be warned. We're going to move on to some project updates at this point. Burnside. So we've got good things happening at Burnside since we acquired it this summer. We began leasing in September in full force. As of Monday, we have 13 occupied units, so 13 households residing at
those are households, really, not just tenants, right?
Not just tenants, they're households, I know.
Apartments occupied.
So we're all very, very excited to get to this point and to keep moving forward. So we'll also be planning a grand opening event sometime this month. So you will be informed on that. A lot of other things are happening this month, and I'll let Amanda kind of update you on all the activity that MOU Hope Forward has been working on in terms of setting up MOUs.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. I'm Amanda Saul from Hope Forward, and we're excited to have so many people living in the Burnside Project. And as property management is continuing to lease up the units on the other side, at Home Forward, we're working on creating the services plan. So working on a contract with Human Solutions to provide general resident services to the whole building, and then also working with Join to provide specific supportive housing services to the 9 permanent supportive housing units that will be there, and then in addition to the 7 units that will have a homeless preference. So and working jointly with both Join, the service providers that they work with, and Human Solutions and IPM, the property management company, to make sure it's well coordinated and we're planning ahead for the future. So that's what we're working on. And then, as Molly was saying, the layering on the project-based vouchers also takes a little bit of time, and so that's happening right now as well. Based on our work with Join and Human Solutions, we have a preference policy in place for families leaving the homeless system and getting on a wait list. Meanwhile, we've had the project-based inspection of the units done, and so we're hoping that towards the end of this month, homeless families will be in to move into those units and the services will be in place. That's exciting. I think that's all I have on that project right now.
Quick question about that. Are there other referral community agencies that are involved in leasing up at Burnside other than Join?
Actually, Jennifer could probably explain. So Join is actually the coordinating agency for the homeless family system of care. So they're actually coordinating across, is it 9 different agencies?
7.
We did sort of twofold, actually. We gave priority access to certain agencies for the 60% lease up, and then this formal partnership with Join, who is then the coordinating agency across all the various agencies.
Okay, thank you.
So lots of agencies.
Okay, but as Burnside in a nutshell, lots of positive things will continue to happen there as we move along.
And we will be inviting you, and we have not picked a date, but we will for an actual grand opening, so you, for those of you who haven't got to see the building, tour the inside and a couple of units, meet some families.
Ice cream. If you want
Alan. I think we'll do hot chocolate for that one.
Burnside, penny on the day. So 30th and Powell, we have movement activities, lots of activities happening with the pre-development, working towards the end road of construction date. So again, I think Amanda can fill us in on more of the details.
Great, thanks. So Home Forward and PHB jointly coordinated and planned a selection committee that met to select the architect. And had participation from Carol, who's in the audience, who represented the neighborhood and others. And the selection committee selected Holst, and Alan also participated, which was fantastic. So now we're proceeding sort of through our contracting process, and Home Forward's board will hopefully approve the contract in October, and then we will quickly move into design. The next step is also in the process of selecting the general contractor. So we're starting that process as well. We'll put out an RFP likely in October, and then start a selection process for that as well. And the RFP will include all of our requirements, all of the city's requirements and Home Forward's requirements related to the MWESB targets. When the architect comes on board in November, the first piece that they'll start working on is a feasibility study of modular versus new construction. So we can really be informed about is modular construction a reasonable type of design to use for this project, and will that get us to any cost savings or time savings? So they'll spend the first 3 months looking at that, and then we'll all make a decision based on that information, and then we'll move forward into design. So our timeline is still a little bit yet to be determined, but the goal is to probably start construction in early to mid 2020, which will give us time for the feasibility study, time for design, and then time for permitting. I'm looking at Bobby to make sure that I'm not missing anything. great.
Okay. And then our lovely piece of land on Northeast Prescott in the Cully neighborhood. Again, I think, you know, we have all along kind of planned to not do anything with that project until next summer. We're still kind of, that's still relatively our timeline. I think what's important to note is that on the 19th of last month, Carl and Amanda and I met with the Cully Business Alliance just to give them a little bit of an update and make connections with them on the project, hear what kind of what their priorities are. We had understood that they had a small pot of resources for commercial development, which this parcel allows, so kind of exploring what those opportunities are. But I think, you know, what we got out of it, what they told us their priorities were family size units and commercial space, and particularly some of the ideas for commercial space that they said they could use in their community were for event space, maker space, childcare, and kind of flexible shared office space, kind of like a WeWork kind of thing for small development. So we'll be keeping that in mind and keeping in communication with that group.
I just want to clarify, so the Cully Boulevard Alliance is the local neighborhood prosperity initiative that has support from Prosper Portland. And then I guess the mixed use piece is something that I'm not sure we have a lot of details about. Is that something that we're considering for all pond projects? Or is that something that we're able to do? And I guess, yeah, I mean, I feel like we haven't discussed a lot about the commercial use using bond dollars and what's the
Yeah, I think that's a good question, Todd. So so it'll come up actually as we work through Powell. We have a potential significant commercial tenant there. You know, there are requirements in city code for active use in mixed use zones. What the city considers active is sort of flexible. You know, obviously the most obvious thing would be, you know, straight up commercial use. But we have, I guess, I don't know if anybody here has this sort of specific experience of what exactly the city would permit as active, but certainly a space that has office or community space, all of that would, you know, would qualify. And I think the real question for us is around the bond funds are obviously limited, and then that however we tenanted that space, you know, would have to make sort of sense financially for the building. So, for example, what you could do, not to get too far into the weeds, what you could do is say we will provide sort of the frame for the, you know, warm shells, sort of the, I guess, the low end of it, right? We would provide that, and then we would have somebody master lease the space, and they would be our tenant, right? So that's sort of one model. Another model would be that it's a community space that is part of the building and serves directly those tenants, or maybe has some sort of outward facing piece to it as well. So all those things are possibilities in the buildings. You know, like I said, the zoning will require us to have some kind of active use. I mean, to kind of go through, you know, in each individual scenario, what makes sense.
I will also make an additional note that there are, we did allow in the bond referral text that the voters approved the actual act, which I don't think we have in our booklet, but it reminds me that we probably should have that for all of us. We did allow the potential to utilize, to fund space if we, you know, could afford it, for certain uses that were related to service of the actual residents in the building. I think there's questions as to what that type of space could be looked at, but if it is something to bond or to fund, it is going to be a discussion that we're going to have with our bond council very explicitly based on the language in the referral documents, and sometimes they lean a little bit more narrow than what we would view as expansive, but knowing that we have to have at least a ground floor space, I think it's a question of what meets that categorization, and I'd invite us to kind of all go back and look at that documentation as well, because it did, I think it specifically called out things along the lines of serving the residents of the building, and we may be more limited than we would like to be in terms of workforce space or other things that the bond could fund. That said, there may be other sources of funding to help bring into the building to support the commercial aspect, and I think that's really a question for all of us. So just a little reminder.
Would the constitutional amendment passing give more flexibility in terms of that commercial space?
Not with bond funds. So it may allow us to leverage or bring in other funds, but the limits that were in the voter referral in 2016 are the limits of what we can spend our bond funds on. It would allow us to do more leverage, but that is always going to be our backstop. As the city, and I will make sure that we have those documents in your, just so you always have those at the forefront of your mind. Memorize the bonds for our language.
And Todd, just to maybe put a finer point on it for you relative to the Cully Business Association. So they had, I think it was $200,000-ish that they said that they might have available to help out. So that's, obviously an investment, but not sufficient to build out an entire space. So, there would be that, in each individual situation, that's our give and take with who those partners are, what they bring to the table, and then what we can plan into the building as we're building it. Because obviously, as the owners of that space, we'd be ultimately responsible for the financial feasibility of it.
I was just going to add one other technical detail that once you have commercial space in a building, it also triggers commercial BOLI, which adds about 15% cost to the entire project, not just the commercial space. So it is a factor to consider as well as we're looking at spaces and costs. So.
I think we had some discussions about that, right? Possibly bifurcating those spaces. That's not the way it works. Okay. Leave it there then.
They don't allow that.
All right.
Unfortunately,
it
would be a good goal.
Right, it'd be a good goal. I mean, I think the Powell building is so big that it's probably less of it. We would pay prevailing wage anyway, and a lot of commercial trades will be there. But on the smaller building there, Prescott, it would definitely, it would definitely have an impact.
Sounds like you have a new advocacy.
Yeah, I do. I might do one more thing on my list.
All right, let's move on to the West Wind, which is our latest soon-to-be acquisition. We are working on our closing and council docs to bring that to City Council for approval, hopefully November 14th, with the closing by the end of the month. In the meantime, we are working to secure property management for the building. Once that's in place, we will be working closely with the current owner to help with that transition period to make sure that everything's lined up and ready to go when we are formal owners. That's Jess.
I was really happy to be able to take part in the decision with the acquisition of the West Wind and the plan for reconstruction. I'm really excited about this project, and I know we've got lots of time for planning ahead, and I just want to express here that I will be interested in seeing if we can look to having increasing the unit count, since the site allows for it, and I understand the design of the programming and the needs of the neighborhood will also need to be taken into consideration, but I will just be looking to have us explore more flexibility with that number.
I think the one thing that we know is that
there's 70 units now, and we know that there'll be at least 70 units going forward, regardless of where we end up. But we'll be spending, the next part of, of next year working on those scenarios and really fleshing out what are all the options and what makes the most sense for the community, for the bond, for the residents, all of that, with lots of updates and input from you all. So that is kind of our timeline overarching as we think we know it as today. One of those scenarios obviously is a redevelopment of the building, which we talked about. So we have some, just very rough estimates what we think that we would look like, and Amanda's kind of helping work on kind of figuring out what those are ultimately going to be and what our options are. So she can talk a little bit more about that.
I think we're in the phase right now where we're just starting to look at options. Initially we went down this path of, what would a rehab look like? And, as with development, you sort of start big and whittle your way down based on information as it comes in, and got to the point where we felt like a new construction was a better option for this particular site. And we talked about that at the site review committee. And now we're looking at different scenarios for the holding period. So, and looking at relocation costs and rehab needs and sort of the different options there. And then we'll move into different scenarios for new construction and look at costs and service needs, target populations. So we're just sort of at the beginning stages of figuring all of that out. But I think this is the exciting time, when you get to think through those things. So.
And similar to what we have done with the Prescott property, yesterday Jennifer and I met with the Old Town Community Association to kind of introduce ourselves to our new neighbors and field some questions that they have about the West Wind and hear kind of what their current concerns and hopes are for that. And we will obviously continue to do that as part of our community engagement process.
May I request that the community engagement, early engagement, also includes some of the service providers who are right located there? I know Paris across the street. I think Central City Concern is Kitty Corner. And many of those service providers are already working in the building, but also work in adjacent to the dynamics of the building. So including them in our early conversations, I think, would be important too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a couple weeks ago, Cheyenne, who's a staff person here, who does a lot of kind of our in-house relocation person, she and I had a tenant meeting at the West Wind after we sent out general information notices to answer questions and concerns that they might have had by receiving those notices. And it was nice to see that there was probably about 10 service providers that showed up that are on behalf of their tenants that
That's
live
great.
There. So that was very useful also to kind of make those connections and get their contact information to be sure that we are informing them and communicating with them alongside the tenants so we can make sure that that's happening.
Thank you.
Just to add to that, we are in the process of having conversations with Central City Concern and formalizing a partnership with them to provide property management services there. Since they actually own and manage the build, like three buildings right in that same block, so it's a good synergy there.
Okay.
Absolutely.
It's perfect time for that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Take a moment. Quick break. We'll be back in 5.
Great job.
We've been busy.
Great job.
I've
done a great job.
I will never say it.
I didn't know you were on yet.
Well, no, I'm actually like Port Lanya.
Essentially,
My alter ego. My full name.
Your name is too long. It's longer than mine. Oh, that sounds okay. Funny, funny.
It's funny too because there's so many different ways to tell Tanya.
There are.
This can be a J or an I.
It's never seen anybody spelled your way.
Right. Because you had a degree, right?
Yes.
Which is kind of like this unicorn.
Do well. Yeah. There are three times.
Someone just called me from there. Whose extension is this?
Yeah.
It's to you. It's a minimum. It's the same.
Also Molly Rogers. We'd like to, we're excited to bring forward this proposed policy for over income acquisition and income rising in place, and this is specific for bond housing. And over the past several months, we've been spending many hours and working through multiple iterations of this policy to bring it to this point. As you can imagine, on face value seems like just kind of a simple, kind of what is the policy, but it intersects with so many different issues and there's a lot of scenarios and that impact household income. So the primary team, myself and Molly and Donna Kelly at Home Forward, who've been working on this, and we've had a lot of feedback also from Shannon and our executive leadership here at the Bureau, as well as our asset management team and compliance here at the Bureau, and Home Forward's staff that's working on the bond. So we've been able to bring in a lot of experience and perspectives on it. The policy aims to accomplish two really important goals. The first is to prevent and minimize involuntary displacement of low-income households. And we want to really ensure that the precious housing that's created by the bond is made available to families and individuals who need it the most. And so those are the two goals of this policy. And a little background is that, as you know, the bond requires housing to be affordable for families and individuals earning at 60% AMI or below. And a household is considered over income when the household income is above that 60%. And households who move into bond units, they're income qualified at that time of move-in. So there's really two scenarios that this policy is addressing where over income may occur. The first is that the city acquires a property with tenants in it, and that there are some households who have incomes over 60%. So that's the first scenario. And the second is that a household who has moved into bond housing and was income qualified at that time has their income rise over time, right, to the point in which they may be earning more than 60%. So those are the two scenarios. So looking at the first one, this is what is we're proposing in the policy, that at the point, so this table just summarizes the income ranges on the left and what would occur in the first year of certification or at the over income. And then the second year and subsequent is the last column. So looking at households that are at 61% to 80%, what we propose is in the first year, they would household would receive a 5% rent increase. And then in subsequent years, the income, that the rent will basically be regulated at an 80% AMI rent level. For the second line down is for 81% or higher, and the first year of certification, the household would receive a 5% rent increase, and then for subsequent years, have a higher 9% rent increase. And we're also proposing these two actions for households who do not complete the income qualification process. We discussed this briefly around the Ellington, that there's a set of households that we just have not gone through income qualification, so we don't know what their income is. So the second scenario is when their income rises in place and becomes over income. So for households who initially qualified at 30% AMI and they increase their income to 60%, they will then receive 5% rent increases until the unit reaches 60% AMI rent level. And then for the two scenarios of 61 to 80% AMI and 81% and higher, it's identical actions are being proposed as just in the prior scenario. So, I guess I'll pause there. Have some discussion.
You first. So I'm gonna have to back up just
yes.
a little bit to make sure I'm understanding the way this works. I think I do, but let's clarify. So first we measure somebody's income, and that either falls to 0 to 30 or 30 to 60 or 60 to 80, right?
Or 81 or higher.
Or any other
that's right.
range. But separately, the rents are set, and we refer to those as, so if you qualify at 60%, there's a specific rent that you qualify for your unit, right? It's not dependent on your actual income, right? It's not 60% of your income,
right?
So there's different levels. Okay. All right. I think that's all. I guess I'll ask my questions. For households who do not complete income qualification process, we have these increases. I guess that's just regardless of if they're in a 30% unit or a 60% unit. So it's for whatever, and it's really just an incentive for them to do the reporting. We're assuming that we're making some assumptions about why.
That's
they're
right.
Reporting.
It's okay. For households we don't know their income. And I'll let Molly.
We know anecdotally because they'll come in and say, oh, I make more than that, so I don't need to go through this process. So presumably the majority of folks who are not income qualifying is because they're over income. But we don't know for sure. That we can't treat them differently than someone who is over income if we don't know.
Because I guess the concern would be if they're way over income, could there be a mechanism that would allow us to correct that situation so that we are serving the populations that we intend to serve? And I don't know how common that is, but it was just interesting that in those areas where there's a potential loophole, could get taken advantage.
Yeah, we had a lot of debate on. Yeah. Is there any income level by which we would terminate someone's lease? And that, of course, as we know, triggers all kinds of other considerations, such as the mandatory relocation assistance program by the city, and also fuzziness around, you know, when, what causes, is that considered a displacing event when the city's funds purchase a building. And since we know with our own data, with our existing properties, of how often this happens, it's so infrequent that we're talking less than 1% of the population are over income. The strategy we are at this point choosing is increasing those households at a higher rate than 5% on an annual basis, so that they can have they will eventually choose to leave.
That stops at like market rate, is that right? Like, you're going to increase the rent 9% up to a certain point, or just?
Nope, just keep going.
Oh, okay.
Beyond market. Okay. So then we can offer that household who will income qualify at turnover. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I've been excited for this policy to take shape, and it's great that we don't have anything like this. We've never had the opportunity to unpack these policy considerations. So I'm really grateful for all the efforts to prepare this and think through all of these scenarios. I had a couple thoughts. If I were queen.
You're not?
No. Not yet. I think we should incentivize people to complete the paperwork, and I would have considered. I would consider a 9% rent increase if we're not receiving information about the household to incentivize that they could reduce that increase to 5% should they complete the paperwork, and that would give us more information about who our tenants are. You may have thought through why that's not a good idea, but that was just my first thought, that I think more information is better for all of us.
Don't mean to respond to that right away. Part of the reason why we're bifurcating the first year from the second year is because we will not know until people come into the office and actually income certify. So we can't guess and say you're going to get 9% for these households. We wanted to be consistent and just do a 5% for that first year, and then that will be that triggering event for them to come into the office and fill out the paperwork, and we'll understand what their income level is, and that's what we will either then sort of right size that rent and or better understand where we are in terms of our overall income targets. So that first year, and then in addition to that, in addition to that understanding that what their actual incomes are, we need to put language in their lease that currently does not exist, that this is now a regulated property, and there may be eligibility provisions that they may have, that they will have to adhere to. So that was the main reason, was that we wouldn't know at that point who would get a 9 versus a 5 in that first year. But at the subsequent years after that we know, then we would have the two different approaches. People had a more modest rent increase approach versus the higher one.
Okay. Sounds good. Just for clarification, what are the rents right now the tenants are paying? Is everyone paying? If they are in any of these over income at acquisition households, are they all paying 60% rent? Are they paying the rent they were paying when we took over the building and the rent has not been adjusted?
So for the folks who are over income?
Yes.
So they would be at the rent at which it was acquired. And we're going to look at whether that was below or above 80% AMI to begin with. So that the rent strategy is looking, we're going to do a comparison of what those income levels would be, or the, sorry, rent restriction, maximum allowable rents would be at 60 and 80, and then sort of right size from there. But it was, the idea is that if the current rents were below 60, we would then raise them. If they were above 60 and people with income qualify between 30 and 60, we would then lower them. But for people who are over income, we just do our 5 and then the 9 after that.
And right now they're paying the rent that they've been paying since we acquired the building?
They have had one rent increase since then.
Okay.
In the 2 years this city, almost 2 years, the city has owned it.
Can you share what the rents are?
I wish I knew on the top of my head exactly what they were.
Okay.
But I can get that to you.
All right. And so those are just thoughts. I actually feel most strongly about my last item here. When rents rise in place, households who initially, this is not in the chart, it's above in the text, households who initially qualified at 30% AMI and increases their income up to 60 will receive a 5% rent increase until it reaches 60%. Having worked with a lot of folks who work to get into affordable housing, and income qualification is a very complicated process, and sometimes people make 33% AMI or 41% AMI. Can we consider rents not just at 30 or 60, but also 30, 40, 50, and 60, so that if someone comes in at a 30, you know, their income rises. They were at 17% MFI when they moved in into the 30% unit, but now they're at 33% MFI, and they're going to likely stay at 33% MFI. They're not going to keep getting pay increases in the job they hold. It would be unfortunate if our policy was to every year raise their rent up to 60% MFI rather than 40% MFI, because then we would be actively rent burdening that household. And my understanding is these would be households who are occupying a 30% unit. I don't see how it would change the financial formula of the building. It's more about making sure tenants are paying rents according to their incomes and not occupying a unit that should be held for other households. So I'm worried about the 33% MFI tenant who's going to be on a path to have their rent increase all the way up to 60%, and wondering if we can consider having other stops along that path, like 40% and 50%.
We did explore that quite a bit. We're trying to balance. It gets so incredibly now nuanced. So the challenge. So we're having rent regulated units, but this isn't a voucher program. So in a voucher program, we'd be income certifying people every few years, and then people's income, you know, the rent portion would alter. This is when we start creating even more steps along the way, we're all of a sudden creating now a whole set of paperwork and certifications and so forth that just rent-regulated properties weren't really set up to be. They weren't really set up to be based on always adjusting based on people's incomes. And that's sort of the square hole in the wrong peg. It's really, really sort of challenging to do that. It would be really figuring out how you're gonna do a step ladder. We could look at, I would personally prefer more thinking about each unit being restricted slightly differently, instead of right now we're in a place where a lot of all these units are going to be either restricted at 60 or 30. And we should be thinking about a more diverse set of income restrictions within a building to sort of address what you're saying. I will say to do 5% rent increases, even from 30 to 60, takes 20 years.
Oh, okay, that's hard.
It takes 20 years to get to that 60% level.
So it's kind of
in a typical tax credit property, we would just go straight to 60 in 1 year. So this is a really much more nuanced, and I think is a much more sensitive policy around this 33% scenario, because I did the math. I was like, okay, so it's going to take 20 years to make up that revenue difference. But that's where we landed.
So that is, it is a policy choice we made from the outset to try to address that issue to some extent. So obviously, we're going to be having vouchers, and out of the 600 units that we'll have at 0 to 30, 400 of them will come with vouchers. And so they'll have a little bit more flexibility in rents. And so there are other folks. This is this policy is actually, quite frankly, putting is making an impact on our operations as it is. But we're trying to be very sensitive to that fact when we, especially when we acquire a building or move tenants in. But it is a policy that we're going to have to watch because it has very real effects. And, and for us, as you know, our goals are set at 30%. And so if we start to stagger down our goals from 60%, we throw everything kind of off the track in terms of actually being able to continue to operate these buildings just on the income that we're raising. So.
That's really, it's really helpful to understand how the time it takes to that significantly adjusts my thinking, so thank you.
Jennifer, Molly, anything else?
Thank you. This was took lots of different. It was a complex issue, and it's complex when you talk about people who are over income or how this plays out for households that are just. We wanted to be really sensitive to folks who were living in properties that the city just happened to buy, and not necessarily automatically displace those folks just by virtue of being, you know. Being the unlucky person at, say, 81%. 81 is very different than 150%. So it's trying to balance all kinds of different goals all into one and trying to do it in a way that isn't totally so nuanced that we have margin of error or we will create a situation where we will do this erroneously, which won't be good either. So I just appreciate the mental prowess, and that we will continue to monitor, of course, because there are going to be scenarios where we will never have anticipated, and we will have to come back together and understand and weigh all the various different sort of issues on that individual household level.
Jennifer has passed me, and I'll say one final thing to you. In looking at the act, which actually authorizes the bond, this is the part that also has the commercial portions of that we are allowed to spend up to 20% of the project funds on a commercial portion. This was in crafting the actual referral. One of the things that was the most challenging for us was this question. When we were limiting the bond buildings to 60% MFI, what happens when someone goes above? What happens when we buy a building? And so we put some language that allowed us to go, or allowed City Council to create some rules regarding hardship. And that's the technical language in the act. And this is attempting to address that. I noticed that Wendy, our attorney, has left the room, but I believe that this is gonna have to be adopted by City Council. And so our first request would be to, and today I don't think is the day for you necessarily to actually adopt it formally, but I do think we want to talk about having a discussion, and we will be bringing this to, in some form or another, to City Council, I believe, whether it's not, or not, it's to authorize us to create a policy of this type and to be able to amend it with this committee, or whether it's actually we have to go to Council each time. And, you know, it's taken us longer than we expected to create this policy, but having the data about the real life data about the, you know, 263 units of the Ellington and talking through some of these very sensitive issues. You know, normally people's rents in 60% units are actually tied to the area median income, as you know. Most years we see maybe 2%. Sometimes we've seen actually a dip in AMI in the last 5 years. This year, we saw 8.9% AMI increase in the metro region. And so we're adopting a more moderate policy than even what is in the general regulated portfolio overall.
But we'll talk to you about next steps more formally with council adoption, but I would expect that we will take this in some fashion to city council to meet the requirements of our bond referral document.
And just the one last point, thank you, is if the constitutional amendment passes and we overlay tax credits and we continue down an acquisition strategy, this policy would have to be adapted, because in order to generate tax credits, people would have to income qualify within 120 days of that certification, and that essentially that acquisition date, which triggers permanent relocation. And so this is the one benefit of not bringing in tax credits, is we can have a much more sensitive and moderate policy to not displace immediately those residents when the city acquires those properties.
On that note, do tax credits have regulation around incomes rising in place, and what happens to tenants who qualify when they move in but their rent's not?
The policy is, yes, there are policies related to the tax credit program. In general, though, if you're 100% tax credit property and everyone income qualified at the beginning, there's no provision that you would ever terminate that lease. If you do have a mixed income property, so you have some market rate, there is such a thing called the next available unit rule. Once certain incomes achieve 140% of the maximum allowable rent level, so at that point, you would have to make sure the next unit that becomes open is restricted back to that whatever 60 or whatever lower of restriction is at that time.
Otherwise, you're there in a 100% affordable building until you choose to leave.
Does that mean we couldn't raise rents on over-income folks? That we wouldn't do this 5% increase for folks?
Correct.
Okay.
Excellent, thank you very much. Quite a bit to process and to think through. A lot of work, and yeah, necessary work. Good work, great questions, great dialogue. Thank you for your energy. And those who stayed, we appreciate your presence. If you have a question, we're gonna come to you in just a moment. We did not review the meeting minutes and information from the last meeting. So if you take a moment, BOC, and do that. Questions on the minutes? Okay, if we're in favor of moving them forward and accepting them as they are, since we don't have a formal voting process, we just acknowledge by shaking your head. Excellent. That means you've been accepted. Any public question, testimony from anyone in the audience? You've got 2 minutes to do so. Well, thanks so much for being here on the 4th of October. Great job, guys, with time recovery. Yeah. We're actually early with a break after starting 25 minutes late. So look at you. Fantastic. Have a great day, everybody. Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Hey, can I do
it
a second? I'm seeing both of you tomorrow, right?
Yes. Right. Yes.
And you're going to be very formal.
Oh.
Very formal.
Oh, yes.
That's right. I don't mean to, like, no one's
questions.
Formal.